Thank you, everyone, for joining us for a Memorial Day Best of Midrats. As our listenership has almost tripled since 2010, there are a few episodes that we did in our first year or so that I wanted to reach back and share for the new listeners who have missed them, or an opportunity for those that listen to it the first time to grab it again. And on Memorial Day, as we think about all those that have gone before us, I think it's nice to touch on rather a unique occurrence in the last few hundred years in the military, and that's the Anglo-American foundation of our success in the field and at sea. And those have been our non-commissioned officers, and I think that's a great topic to visit this Memorial Day weekend. And we're going to reach back to November 2010 to a special we had on NCO leadership and visit with some people many of y'all already know, either online or off. We have three guests back in 2010. A fellow blogger, a shipmate, and friend, YN2 Lucien Gaultier, also AT1 Burlman, also from the United States Navy, and we're going to have MK1 Turner from the United States Coast Guard to talk about their experience as being a non-commissioned officer right in the meaty center of what makes our Navy and our Coast Guard what it is today at sea and ashore. And I hope that everybody has a great weekend, and if you come back next weekend, which I hope you do, please join us for a live show where we're going to have returning guest Mackenzie Eaglin. She's a resident fellow at the Marilyn Ware Center for Security Studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and she's going to be with us for the full hour to discuss the top national security issues we can expect to see rise to the top in the 2012 presidential election season. Thank you very much. I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers. We've got a triple header today. It's a kind of a change of pace. We've done the last few shows. We've had them for the full hour, so I'm going to try to be a fast-talking Southerner as much as possible. We have three guests to discuss the role of the non-commissioned officer in the U.S. Navy and also the U.S. Coast Guard, and kind of talk about what we need them for, what their specialties are, and what they really bring to the table for the maritime services. And to do that, we have a returning guest to Midrats, Yeoman Second Class Surface Warfare, H. Lucien Gaultier III. And also, we have Aviation Electronic Technicians First Class Aviation Warfare, Charles H. Burlin, Jr. And finally, to round out the hour, we're bringing our sister maritime service on, from the U.S. Coast Guard, Machinery Technician First Class Tony Turner. And right out of the blocks today, in addition to be a returning guest to Midrats, he's a fellow blogger, co-blogger with Eagle One and myself over the USNI blog. And you can also find him at a variety of other locations in the blogosphere. YN2, Lucien Gaultier. We also have been in the Navy since 2006, so he's kind of the junior NCO present afloat to that extent, but he's made the most out of it. He took a one-year IA while he was still on his first sea tour, and he had just come back from one-year IA to Afghanistan, where he was both in Bagram and also Kandahar. In December, he'll detach from his first sea tour, which was on board the USS San Antonio, LPD-17, and go ahead and feel free to turn green a little early. He's reporting to a great set of orders with Admiral Stavridis over at SHAPE. So after the holidays, he'll be heading to what will hopefully be an outstanding tour. I know he'll bring a lot to the shop over there in Mons, Belgium. Lucien, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you, Skir. It's good to be aboard again.
Hey, just coming out of the blocks, first of all, thanks for helping out the ground services here for a year and heading over to Afghanistan for a year. And if you could, please tell the listeners how long you've been back. And since you've been back and you had time to take a deep breath and decompressed, what have you enjoyed the most now that you're back?
I've been back since the beginning of the month primarily. I believe I got back here into Norfolk 1 November. That was with a 27-hour stint in San Diego to go through NMPS out there. And the number one thing I've enjoyed the most since being back is honestly just the downtime, the chance to go up to D.C., go by Annapolis, meet everyone over at USNI, and really get to go to the waterfront again, get to see all the ships, remember that, hey, guess what, there is a Navy out there. You know, there's more to just, U.S. Navy name tag on ACUs, and slowly but surely reintegrate both to, you know, civilian life during my liberty and to Navy life aboard the ship.
Eagle One?
Well, when you got back, just to keep on that thread a little bit, what stunned you the most about when you get back to the States? I know for my stint in Saudi Arabia when I came back, I was just amazed how green things were.
Yeah, absolutely. Primarily, number one thing visually is all the colors. You know, you spend enough time out there in Kandahar, and the color taupe just becomes omnipresent. You just get used to that and accept the fact that you will not see any colors aside of that and maybe, you know, army green. Also, being back, well, honestly, there wasn't that much to shock me coming back. You know, I was fairly omnipresent online. I was fairly plugged into everything that was going on, one, aboard my ship, and two, with just the happenings in my family, my friends' lives through, you know, Facebook, Twitter, email, Skype. I can make phone calls home all the time. So there wasn't really any big shocks, any big surprises for me when I returned. That said, you know, knowing something abstractly through word of mouth and actually being a part of it again, that was a pretty big jump right there.
Lucia, I think one thing that's kind of neat about your experience is you haven't been in the Navy for very long, really, but you didn't come into the Navy at age 18 either. You had a few more years of seasoning on your belt. But when you headed off to your IA, you were still on your first set of sea duty orders. So you really had a very focused view. Here's the Navy. Here's how we operate at sea. And then somebody flips a switch. They put you in a set of Army uniforms, and then you head over to not just a joint environment, but really a joint combined environment with some of our international partners. And you're able to see the way that our sister services work, but also the way other nations work, and specifically how their non-commissioned officers are given responsibilities or work in the general scheme of things. What were some of your first observations you saw when you got there, and over time, what was some of the nuance that came out that maybe the Navy could learn from the way other NCOs and other services and other nations work?
Within a few months of me first reporting there, I was working fairly late in the evening, and the command sergeant major for the unit I was working with came in. That's the Army's analog of a CMC. And speaking with him, I mentioned the fact that an E3 soldier and an E3 sailor, there's not a very big difference between the two of them, you know, primarily because neither one had been truly been indoctrinated to the culture yet. Neither one had had to really step into the shoes of leading another group of either soldiers or sailors. That said, I also told him that, you know, once you got up to the E5, E6 level, you started seeing some important distinctions between the two, primarily between the Army and the Navy. What that is that the Navy, we really cross-train, especially on a San Antonio class. You have to be a jack of all trades. You have to know 15, 16 things that you wouldn't have expected when first reporting. The Army, very specific, very discreet MOSs, you know, administration on board a ship. I had to do everything from correct, you know, the 50-50 for the upcoming retirement ceremony to going ahead and proofreading a NAM for sailor whoever, to even, you know, I was TADTAR manager for an extended period of time aboard my ship. When I got out there with the Army, you know, they plunked me down at a desk. They told me to start banging out awards, and they never asked me to do anything different, you know, except for maybe carrying boxes of water. So that was a big distinction. You know, not to critique the Army too much, but the other thing I noticed is that due to that discrete nature between their MOSs, whenever something out of the blue came up and they had to deal with that, they were a lot less adaptive than the average sailor is. You know, the biggest thing about the Navy that I really like is how adaptive we make ourselves be, how we throw a variety of things at an individual at a very junior level, and then expect them to go in and perform and, one, learn on their own. You know, you still get implicit guidance and control back from the chain of command, but at the same token, you have to make that knowledge personal and internalize it quickly because, you know, you get your qual in November, and by July, you're going to be the guy signing off at PQS for the next sailor coming up. So there's not a big turnaround. And because of that, I find us to be the most adaptive service out of all the services.
Did you have a chance to intermingle with petty officers at your level E4, E5 equivalents from the other coalition forces that were over there? And how did you find them?
It was really only on a social level that I got to interact with them much. My unit that I was out there with did have attachés from other allied forces with us, but again, they were on the senior officer level. They weren't really on the enlisted level. I could go down to the the boardwalk down there at Kandahar and go get a cup of coffee at Tim Hortons and I can interact with them there. So on that level, a service member is a service member regardless of their heritage or language. They're all there for the same reason. They all have the same end goals, and because of that, you see eye to eye immediately. You have something in common. Professionally, I can't really comment too much towards that.
One of the takeaways that I took for I did not spend as much time in Afghanistan as you did. I was just in the greater Kabul area, just wandering off to various garden spots for a few days at a time. But as a Navy guy, the one thing that I took away was a brand new appreciation and comfort level with weapons. And I remember as a junior officer, you would actually hear senior at the time officers, literally say, "I would never trust my third class petty officer with a weapon." And you just sit there and blink at them. But I think that's one thing that's happened in the last decade is, at least in the Navy, we've had to be a lot more comfortable with carrying personal weapons. After a year of taking it with you everywhere but to the head, more or less, have you developed a better appreciation for weapons? And why I bring that up is in the last year, there's been quite a few incidents of both individual and crew-served weapons firing because people didn't have proper handling procedures. Do you think a solution to that would be more training, more carrying of the weapons, or was there anything significant you took away when it came to actually handling weapons on a day-to-day basis?
Yes, there was. That question kind of hits close to home, too. In the training that we have to go through for going out to Afghanistan, the Army goes ahead and they actually have drill instructors from, they were reservists in my case, come and train us all up on weapons handling and procedures in Army terms. The training that they gave us, while we're going through it, we actually had two JAG captains that were going IA. They were both the two senior personnel president in our class. Towards the end of the class, one of them stood up and mentioned to the instructors that he found it nothing short of remarkable how in 2 short weeks they took a group of sailors that by any means were not really confident with their weapons initially, and now we were shooting targets at 300 meters range, from the prone kneeling position, strong arm, strong left, weak arm, strong eye, weak eye. And that was just unheard of thus far in Army training or in Navy training. I tried to do VBSS prior to my IA. I was able to get through it because of the practical shooting exercises where you have to actually move and shoot. My number one problem was that I didn't realize that my left eye was my strong eye, whereas my strong arm is my right arm. Going through all the way up to the team trainer at the VBSS level, they were not able to diagnose that problem with me. First, either one or two trips to the range with the Army, they hit the nail right on the head, and thereafter, I was shooting sharpshooter. I wasn't getting perfect, but I was, I qualified for that S device on my ribbons. So that was a very big culture difference. Insofar as carrying the weapons around day to day, by month 9, I no longer considered it, a blessing. I started considering it a burden, honestly. That thing was just heavy. We called it a musket. Just to be able to spend time with your weapon, get comfortable with your weapon and treat it as an asset rather than a liability is a huge boon to any individual carrying a weapon because you have to look at it as an asset. You can't look at it as a liability, especially if you're a senior, if you're a leader and you're looking at your guys carrying the weapons as a liability. How do you even trust them to get tactical with it? How do you really trust them to engage with it when you're more concerned about them? Oh, God, are they going to shoot the bulkhead? Are they going to go and shoot someone down in downtown Norfolk? That's day one stuff. If we haven't gotten past that, we don't have a competent force to go ahead and protect our assets.
Well, speaking of leadership, now that you're an E5, can you kind of sum up in a few short, well-chosen words the difference between what you know now and what you didn't know when you first got in the Navy?
Adaptability. That's the number one thing. The number one thing is adaptability, and it all starts there, and if you can't get that right, it ends there. You know, being on an optimally manned platform, you have a lot of things that seem to come out of the blue. You don't really get a lot of explanation for what's going on, and it should have been done right probably 3 weeks to a month ago, but it's not. So the ability to go ahead and take that in, be told where the, you know, the gaps may lie and what should have been already performed, and go ahead and figure out how to do it, especially when you might have only been doing this aspect of shipboard life for a few weeks, that's the biggest thing. When you have junior personnel coming up to you, and they're, you know, I've only been in E5 now for barely 2 years, they're looking to you for answers because you're the old salt all of a sudden, and your ability to articulate to them, well, A, B, and C might have happened, and that's why we're having to do D, that's an incredibly important asset. So those two aspects, going ahead and creating more certainty for the junior personnel and being able to be malleable and adaptable for your leadership, that's the core right there.
Yeah. Now, coming back to, you know, the shipboard NCO view, after your year, you've come back, and for the crew of the USS San Antonio, this has been an exceptionally difficult year for a lot of reasons. There's a lot of distractions, and a lot of times we'll read articles on leadership, but it's always from a macro level. Somebody with a PhD or some flag officer has written something, but especially when you're in a unit that is under external stresses that can lead to morale problems, it's really the NCOs at the deck level. They're keeping the junior crew focused. What have you seen amongst your shipmates there that they've reacted to a lot of the news that showed up in the last few months? And down there at the deck plate level, where do you see is your role or the roles of NCOs in general to not put out happy talk, but to get people focused on the mission at hand as opposed to the background noise that might be going on?
It's been interesting coming back because, like I said, I was fairly well plugged in to all the happenings that were going on board, but I wasn't there to experience it firsthand. So coming back, I have something of a, you know, slight background in it, but an objective observation of it just the same. With that, kind of hard to say without, you know, maybe saying too much. There's inevitably, you know, first and foremost, San Antonio's been through as much as the Navy can put anybody through without actual combat. I can say that unequivocally. In talking to other sailors online and other sailors from other platforms, they have no context through which to understand what San Antonio is. So just like combat, you'll have certain individuals that'll either buckle under the pressure or they'll rise to the occasion. Coming back and having a fairly objective eyes at this, it kind of surprised me who has and who has not risen, who is crushed, who is going ahead and, you know, forging ahead. I don't want to name particulars, but especially with E5s for some reason, petty officers, second classes, I've been able to, maybe it's just because that's my peer group, but I've been able to ID certain key aspects on board, certain key individuals on board the ship that have really risen, that are really acting as a cement in a lot of aspects. Any further explanation than that, I got to get a little bit too specific and maybe name names. So it's about the best I could do.
Well, as you look back and as you look ahead, as you move to new assignments and you get people assigned to you, what of the lessons you've learned do you plan to bring aboard the people who'll be working for you?
Probably the biggest thing that I've learned is that at a given time under enough stress, an individual needs to find a way to go ahead and unload this emotional baggage. And through no conscious effort of their own, they find the path of least resistance to go ahead and unload all this emotional baggage. You know, the Navy will go ahead and say, you know, when you're coming home, oh, don't beat up your family. Don't talk, you know, don't talk bad to anybody. You know, be calm. They give you downtime and everything like that. But a leader needs to be conscious of where that individual is most likely going to go ahead and unload that baggage. You have to anticipate it, and you have to go ahead and really you have to help foster get that out of them. You have to ease them into, you know, decompressing and being able to stay focused, because when that emotional baggage builds up, that's when focus is lost, that's when cohesion is lost, and that's when individuals start making bad decisions. And that's the most key thing. In terms of how to develop junior sailors, I'm kind of at a loss because, you know, the unspoken truth of optimal manning is that, you know, mid-grade petty officers have no one to lead. I reported aboard San Antonio as a YNSN. You know, my buddy reported the same day as me, so it was me and him came up the ranks to E5, there was no one filling in behind us. So I was always kind of, even as an E5, the junior guy in the office. So I'm still at a little bit of a loss as to what it is to develop subordinates.
Lucian, now that you're obviously your mind is already starting to shift towards your next set of orders, but the IAs for Navy personnel isn't really going anywhere. So if there was a sailor out there who is either going to volunteer or has been told he's going on an IA soon, what would be kind of your top five pieces of advice for them as they get ready to go on that IA?
Number one, be patient with the Army. Number two, make sure you know where your weapon is at all times and get used to carrying it. Number three, learn the Army lexicon as fast as you can. Number four, don't lose your sense of being a sailor. Keep your culture close and tight-knit. And number five, remember there's a light at the end of the tunnel and it will be over eventually. You know, and apply the lessons learned from the Army back to the Navy, because you juxtapose those two, there's a lot of knowledge to be gained.
Perfect. And Lucian, if people wanted to read some more, because I know you're out there typing away on your keyboard on a regular basis, if people wanted to read some of your stuff, where could they reach out and find it?
Facebook, number one. That's where I put most of my random thoughts. I'm on there, just, you know, H. Lucian Gothier III. There's not many Lucians. It's pretty easy to find me on there. On Twitter, I'm Surface Sailor. There's even, you know, shorter snippets of random thoughts. And then, as you said in my intro, you know, I blog with you there at USNI, so it's easy to find me there too.
Okay, Lucian, thanks a lot for coming back and spending some time with us on Midrats. I think we, as usual, could have kept going for another hour, but I wish you the best of luck in the holiday season and transitioning to Mons, Belgium. You're in for a great set of orders. And the senior officer president afloat over there, I think his reputation speaks for himself. So thank you very much for your service, and good luck on your next set of orders.
Thank you, sir, and it was an honor to be aboard again.
Thank you, Lucian.
Thank you.
Okay, everybody, we're going to move on to the second half of the second third of the show, actually, with our second guest going from the surface and a little bit of the wearing Army clothes over to the air side of the house with our second guest, AT-1 Charles Burlman. He's been in the Navy since 1998 with tours over at AIMD on the USS Enterprise. We just missed each other by a few months, by the way. And his last two tours have been with VAQ-130, and now he's with VAQ-135, doing the Lord's work there, getting ready for the EF-18 Golf to get up and running. Charlie, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks, Sal.
Now, here's a little bit of a question here for you. If you could, for the readers, those that didn't have a chance to see the extended background that I put over my home blog for you, I think your last sea tour is about a perfect example of what the Navy we've had and the deployments that we've had in the last decade that really is in the background, because this is a ground-centric war, and what little things you see out in the press has to do with, you know, what's taking place on the deck. If you could, please, just outline for everybody those three deployments that you went through and the timeline that incurred on that.
Well, okay. You know, as my home blog, as your home blog said in the notes I sent you in Eagle One, I rolled off the Enterprise. I was in 2001 with opening up OEF. I mean, GQ, we went to GQ and all the other fun stuff with that because we didn't know what was going on. We came home in 2001 November, actually Veterans Day. Went to the yards. I transferred to school, middle school. I picked orders to go to a VAQ community because I like fixing airplanes more than I like sitting inside of a ship. I rolled right into there, and I rolled right into the middle of a workup cycle. VAQ-130 had just come off a cruise, not even 9 to 10 months prior to that, as part of the opening shots of OEF on board the Truman. When I checked in, we were rolling right into a 30-day deployment on the Truman, which also we were told midway through that workup cycle, oh, by the way, this is FRP testing. So we did a short overseas port visit, which blew everybody's mind who was used to old school Navy. We went to Naples in the summertime, which is Naples in the summertime is nice, kind of, sort of. And we were forward deployed because that was then a secret, you know, those, if you can roll your way back machines back to then, that was that secret passover between the USA control to the Iraqi government control. We came back from that. We rolled down to Cag Fallon later in August, rolling into September. Dumb luck, we happened to be there the same time in Tilhook, and went to that with some family friends and saw some old school people I grew up around as a kid. We finished Cag Fallon in September, and in late November of 2004, we were on deployment, and we returned. We went to the Mediterranean, did Naples again, did through the ditch, straight into the Gulf, and we were putting prowlers overhead. Our skipper at the time, who's now the current Commodore of Combat Wing Pack, Commander Slace, we were putting prowlers overhead. We were the night crew, the Marines ashore at Al-Asad, the day crew, and we were doing our EW thing. Within reason, I can't talk all the ins and outs about it. One of the best things I can ever say we did with that was, I think it was, probably about April or May, they had the election. We had two airplanes tore down and complete phase inspection in the hangar bay, put back together because CAG and NSOC and CENTCOM wanted maximum EW effort overhead to prevent stupidity. And we put four prowlers overhead. In a period of 24 hours, we had maintenance guys crawling over these jets, and anybody that's worked around them knows they're maintenance intensive. We put them up overhead, and next thing we know, there were no attributable EW suicide attacks potentially because of what we did. We came home, we had about 9 months downtime, and then we were told, due to the Marines being deployed in Al-Asad and Bagram, we needed to gap the billet to go to Iwakuni, so we came home, about June, July of 2005. We were off until January of 2006, and we were doing workups, Red Flag, Point Magoo for a live harm shoot, and we were then, I was part of the early debt that went in first week of June to Iwakuni, and it looked like the day I landed was when the Norks launched that Idong over Japan and scared the jeebs out of everybody. Main body came in, and for about 90 days we flew ops with MAG-12. We left in October, and the day we left, the Norks detonated detonation of a nuclear weapon. Everybody kind of freaked out, and they were talking about extending us but our airplanes were already at wake on the way over, going home. So we came home. We were home probably about another 8 months, and then we were rolling right into workups again. JTFX, COM2X, TESTA, CAG Fallon, and I was on cruise again in 2007. And then that was 2007 was the time period where we started seeing the extended deployments in the VAQ community and carrier aviation and journals, where it used to be 6 months, now we're because of FRP and because ships need downtime and yard time, you're looking at 6 to 7, 7 to 8, 7 to who knows, whenever. That deployment 2007-2008 was 7 months long. I came home, I got married in November of 2008, and I rolled right over to VAQ on 30 in December, and I hit workups again, and I was gone for 9 months. I came back in about March, was home for 2 months, and then rolled down to Lemoore for 5 months of school this past summer.
Amazing. Wow. Eagle One?
Yeah. Talk about your shop on a carrier. How many sailors do you have? What kind of lessons do you try and teach them? How many people and how much of what you try and teach do you attribute to people who taught you?
Well, one of the biggest things I shop manning in an EA community. According to paper, we should have 22 guys, and that's spread up and down the pay grades. Realistically, you're looking at anywhere between 15 to 18, give or take. But I'm going to give up four of those bodies at least to T.A.D. Billets. That's being the Admiral's personal fluffer for his stateroom. That's being the laundry guy. That's being two or three guys down the mess stick. So then in reality, I got two shifts working basically 12 on, 12 off on out to sea, running anywhere between six to seven bodies. And one of the things I was taught, one of the things I try to teach everybody, and I actually had a few chiefs and a few officers look at me when I have done in briefs and things, is read the instructions. Read every pub you can think of. Read it all. Because there are times and places someone's going to say, you can't do this, and I've pissed people off by pulling down their instructions and flipping open and finding chapter and verse. No, no, no. See right here, boy? This says I can do this, and this says you need to help me out. And if you want to have an issue, I'll talk to my khaki mafia, and they can talk to you. All right? And because one of the things that drives me up the wall is people who get into positions and into jobs who then sit around on their duff and don't want to help anybody out, and they want to hold their little rice bowl. But one of the things I try to teach everybody is learn everything you can about all the instructions. Don't be the SME about them or subject matter expert, but learn where they are, what you can do, and what you can find, and where you can find them. Because that's also gotten me out of trouble so many times. There's been a few times when I've stood my ground and told, as a CDI, I said, no, this says it's down. End of discussion in the maintenance control. And I've had people say, and finally I pull up the publication and said, see, we got to do X to equal Y for Z. And I ain't got enough time to do that. So this airplane's down until we can get it done. And long of the short of it is, I've had people rule in my favor because I knew where the pubs were and what my job and what the instructions said. And that's why I try to teach everybody.
And I'll tell you what, that's a lot of people underestimate the admin aspects of leadership, because what you outlined there is something I would always tell my junior officers. I was like, listen, you need to know Ref A, because you can argue all you want to about what you think or what you feel or what you emote, but I want to know what you know in accordance with the Navy. And you're right, you got to know Ref A, because that's the way the Navy works in the documents. And you know, speaking of knowing your stuff, I don't know if you had a chance to read about it, but over at our friend Galran's place at Information Dissemination this week, he posted up the Jagmen on our previous guest ship, the San Antonio. And one of the things that really hit home, because it's something that I think people have been complaining about for decades, but with this optimal manning, just-in-time manning, it's become even more of a problem. And that was the required training, whether it's
right.
CBT or face-to-face, because especially in the aviation side of the house where you are, and you touched on it briefly, when you're especially with I hate this phrase, but it's what we use, high-demand, low-density asset like yours, people are important. You need those collateral duties inspectors, and you need more than one, your CDIs. You need your quality assurance representatives, and you need more than one. There's all these qualifications you need, and your junior personnel, the more qualifications and training and being able to actually fix things so you can do your mission is critical. But there's this huge admin wedge that's been forced on us. What have you seen in the last decade? You've been in since 98. Are we getting any better or worse when it comes to the amount of time we spent on the admin side of the house?
Okay. You touched on optimal manning. Now, current command I'm in, 135, and when they went out for their 2004 deployment, they actually did a test plan that Air Forces had come up with, where optimal manning, where they literally had 10 guys in the AT shop. And now, everybody else up and down the flight line, when we heard this, when these guys were left, we're like, that ain't possible, because at a bare minimum, just to do one of the maintenance evolutions, you need five people to upload and download an airplane. So we looked at that and said, that ain't going to work. But we got pats on the head from the engineering side, the and I hate to use this term here, but the khaki mafia, which it's a derogatory term I use around some of my junior sailors to explain some of the more shady people. And you know, if either one of you have been around, you know what type of chiefs and officers I'm talking about when I mention khaki mafia. They tell us, we know what we're doing. You don't know anything. But we're the SMEs down there. We're the technicians. We know what our jobs are supposed to be. Optimum Manning and CBT, we're starting to see kids come in from A school that have gone through CBT. And I literally talked to one who's now a second class. He came to me in 2006, just after he got back from Route 21, still with the Zappers. He had gone through A school with CBT. He said it was just click through the test until you got the answers right. There were kids with notepads writing down stuff. I'm not a great electrician in all the inside and outside of the math, but I know enough to do the logical troubleshooting. And when you're trying to explain, well, the reason why this radio isn't working, the reason why you're getting reflection back on this line is because of this, I get the glass-eyed look. And anybody that's been a teacher, you know the glass-eyed look when you've just lost somebody. So then that makes it harder, because one of the things you need to do, especially on our side, is logical troubleshooting. Logically being able to sit down and look at a component and understand, well, the reason why it isn't doing this is because of this. And the reason it isn't doing this is because this little component is broken. CBT is killing us in that sense. Optimum Manning is killing us in the fact that they're trying to downsize the Navy to be a form-fit function, but there's going to be maintenance-heavy evolutions. Just like I mentioned in the opening, I mean, I gave up 3 or 4 bodies to go down and be S2M, working and washing pots and pans in the galley, or washing the dishes that everybody eats off on the ship, or just wiping down the tables and stocking all the sodas. Okay, if I got a shop of 12 people and I got to give up 4 bodies, I got then 8 guys that are struggling to maintain a 4-5 airplane flight schedule at times. Ain't going to happen. Not to the point where I got guys that are coming in, they're tired. They're going to be, you know, again, it's QARs, it's CDIs, overlooking something. Then I'm putting not only the 2 air crew I just stuffed into a $65 million jet, and each air crew is about $1.2 to $1.5 million, but I got everybody on the damn flight deck who's of threat and risk too, because did he look at that right, or is he just too tired and just did his cursory thing because he needed to move on to the next evolution to get another airplane up?
Well, speaking as the father of a Navy pilot, I want you to take as much time as you need to do your job right. And if I were your CO, and I have been a CO, I would support you all the way in that. And that khaki mafia you're talking about, I know who you are talking about. You're on the right. Just keep it up.
Yeah. And, I mean, you guys had on earlier one of my skippers, Commander Ware, and he had 3 things. He said, take care of your people, do the right thing, and do the best of your abilities. And those are the 3 things I live by. And one of the things that my dad taught me, who spent 22 years in the Navy, and he grew up with some of the chiefs that were near the end of their World War II careers who were coming, and he came in the 1960s, who were just getting ready to leave. He always taught me, don't do dumb things. You know, and that's one of the ways I try to live by my life. And, you know, in your previous guest, Lucian, as an E5 and even as an E6, there were times I don't have the answers, but what you got to do is you don't tap dance in front of your junior guys. You know, that's the biggest thing I can stress to him. You don't tap dance in front of your junior guys. You say, I mean, sometimes even an I don't know, but let me go find out is a lot better answer than, well, this is what I think. Because what sometimes, you know, anybody that's been around the military knows logical sense doesn't always make sense. You know, and how decisions are made. And the last thing I can give as a piece of advice to anybody who's going to be a leader, especially the mid-grade leaders like we're at right now, is keep your sarcasm inside the mess to the best of your ability.
Yeah, I think the sarcasm is shocking to come from me, but I think sarcasm at the wrong place, at the wrong time, has created more conflict in a ship. And let me ask you this point here, because you really, you got it hard and heavy on the deployment side of the house, and you've seen the importance of everybody being able to lean in to get the mission done.
Right.
If you had a 5-minute slot with CMP over, you know, NAVPERS and Fleet Forces Command, Admiral Harvey at a desk, and they ask you, okay, what can I do for these guys in initial training and in A school to give you a better product when they first show up for their first tour AT-1? What do you need from me? What would you tell them is that one thing they need?
Well, what I would say is we need to go back to, I mean, especially in my side of health, we need to go back to not using, I mean, computer-based training is a nice tool, but hands-on training and explain. I mean, I was a poor math student going throughout school, but when I rolled into A school, all right, we literally went from 2 plus 2 to some basic differential calculus, and what had happened was that some of the civilian instructors and some of the Navy instructors said on like a Monday, okay, here's how you do differential calculus, here's your homework, go home for the day. So we'd beat our heads over this stuff, and then they'd come in, and then we would get electrical theory, and it would show exactly how that all mirrors up. Same thing with doing our job here. We need to expand. We need to show not only the theory, but show that hands-on application of why this is going to work the way it's going to work. You know, so that way, for a lot of people, that little spark, whether it's a candle, whether it's a full-on light bulb, or whether it's a 8,000 loom, you know, spotlight, comes on in their mind and goes, aha, now I get it. And they can, you know, once they roll over to their C school for advanced training, they understand how some of these systems are going to work inside the system they're going to work on. Whether you're a gunner's mate trying to figure out how, you know, a 5-inch 54 works and a computer system there, you know, that you need to have the gearing mechanisms work a certain way, or a bosun mate, even learn how to launch a boat from a David, you know, understand all those systems, how that all comes together. The theory in the classroom needs to be applied to at-hand application.
AT-1, well, I'll tell you what, thank you very much for coming in this Sunday, actually. Give us 20 minutes of your time. And I hope you're enjoying not having to deploy next week again for a change. And
yeah.
Look forward to hearing from you again soon. I hope you have a good holiday season.
You too. And anytime you want to have me back on, boss.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles. Is there an A school for pillow fluffing?
Okay, on that note, we will leave the fluffing and the fluffers for a different show at a different time. We're going to move on finally to our third guest for today. From the last 20 minutes of our show, we're going to shift over to our sister maritime service, the United States Coast Guard. And we're pleased to have as their representative today, MK1 Tony Turner. He joined the Coast Guard back in 1998, the same time our previous guest joined the Navy. And he is currently assigned to United States Coast Guard Cutter Escanaba, homeported in Boston, Massachusetts. So, of course, if Tony ever needs a beer, all he's got to do is go find Boston Maggie. She tolerates Coast Guard people in addition to Navy types. His previous units include the Coast Guard Station Rockland, Maine, also the Cutter Campbell and the Integrated Support Command New Orleans, Louisiana. Tony, welcome to MIDRATS.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate y'all having me on the show.
Now, judging from your accent, I could tell that you're a lot more comfortable down in Louisiana than you are up in Boston and Maine. So how's a Southern boy like yourself adjusted to living up in the Great White North?
I like to consider myself a transplant Yankee by now, because I've been in the Coast Guard for like 12, 13 years, going on 13 years now, and pretty much all of it's been spent up here besides the four that I spent in Louisiana, so... I'm a transplant Yankee, Boston Bruins fan, I root for the Red Sox, so not too much down south except for my accent and hoping to go back on the next tour.
Well, that's a good thing because they can't understand you and you can't understand them. But I think you've got an advantage over them that they've heard more from than anything else. We had a real good talk with your skipper a few shows back. Because one thing that has always impressed me about the Coast Guard is just, in my opinion, looking at it from a distance, is the Coast Guard seems to give its leaders, not just at the junior officer level, but also at the NCO level, a lot of responsibility and an opportunity to lead. If you could take a moment on how you view the Coast Guard's NCOs, and if you've had a chance to work with the Navy or talk with the Navy as well, is there a way for our listeners, which are mostly Navy types, that they might have a better understanding of the Coast Guard NCO and how that might be a little different than your version in the Navy?
I haven't dealt with the Navy too much, but the only thing that I can say that cross-references between the Navy and the Coast Guard, in my opinion, is that the Coast Guard, we're a very small service, and so we have a lot more packed into, I think, our job descriptions and what we're responsible for. Like myself, just on board, I'm responsible for hydraulics, I'm responsible for engines, I'm responsible for potable water systems, aviation fuel systems, and, you know, so on and so forth. It goes on down the line, and that's, you know, that's throughout the Coast Guard. When you get to a small boat station, you know, the first class might be, you know, leading the engineering department and having to deal with, you know, various aspects of the shore life, and when you get on big cutters like ours and the 378s and so on and so forth, it's just a lot put on, you know, just that one individual plus that shop. It's a lot of knowledge that you have to gain in a very short amount of time, and like I heard your first guest talking about the transfer season, when we go through such big transfers on the boat, you know, it's only 100 and something people, and when you lose, like, let's say 30 people a transfer season, you're losing a lot of that experience. And then you get these guys in, you have to get them trained up. And then by the time they're trained up and ready to take over their role, then you have another changeover. So the changeover rate is, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's very challenging when you go through it because you're going through it every year.
As you were coming up through the Coast Guard, I assume you had certain mentors, and I assume you do mentoring now. What lessons did you learn from your mentors, and how do you mentor your young sailors?
One of my biggest mentors was a chief that I had on the Campbell, and he just taught me to lead. You don't have to necessarily lead through your power and your position. You can lead through, you know, like a personal leadership standpoint. If you lead and if you're fair with your guys, you know, they're going to treat you the same. They're going to give you back what you give them. So I try to be open and honest with my guys. I try to be fair with my guys, treat everybody equal, and they give it back to me. So I don't like to use my position as a first-class petty officer and, you know, the supervisor to, you know, rule the shop, if you want to say. I like to, you know, put out there to my guys that they can come up to me with any problems. I will either help them find the answer or I will give them the answer and give them the tools they need to better equip themselves for future endeavors.
One interesting thing about the Coast Guard is the fact that you don't have these huge commands, you know, like Charlie did his first tour over at AIMD on the Enterprise, and having been on the Enterprise and other carriers, you know, you can go on a complete deployment and not even see somebody, but you don't have that pleasure or that luxury, depending on how you look at it, at the Coast Guard. So you really don't have time to walk away or get away from people. What do you think are some of the top tools that leaders can use if you have some personality frictions between a couple of your Coast Guardsmen that are just going to have to live with each other for the rest of deployment or the end of their tour, you can help use to resolve that?
Now, you definitely got to find outlets because, like you said, you know, it's 270 feet. You don't have very far to travel to get away from somebody if you're mad at somebody or if, you know, you just have friction between you. So you just have to find your outlets. You know, different people have different things. And, you know, don't be afraid if you do have a problem with somebody, just, you know, talking to that person, or if you can't resolve it at the personal level, then take it up the chain of command. In the Coast Guard, you know, like you said, we're a very small command, but our chain of command is there, set in place for a reason. And in my experience, it's been phenomenal. It works every time. You know, if I can't resolve something with somebody, we take it up to the next level. You know, and the chief's mess is great. They're the midpoint, if you want to say, between us and the officers. And we all, you know, if there's a problem, take it to the chief's mess. If they can't handle it, then, you know, they'll take it further. But, you know, always rely on your next you know, your next level in the chain of command. Don't just, you know, throw hands down and say there's nothing we can do about it, because conflicts can be resolved, and lowest level possible is the best way to do it.
What are, out of a ship of 100 men, how many, or persons these days, how many first class are on board one of your medium cutters?
Let's see, we have three first classes. We have myself and a couple other guys. We have an FS1 who helps run the like the cooks and support. We have like one, two, three operations first classes. We have one deck side of the house, one deck first class of BM1, and Y1, SK1 for support side of the house. I think that's it. I think I named everybody.
You know, part of the, especially in your specialty as a machinery tech, you know, things people like to argue the most about ships, especially when you're building new ships and coming up with them, it's weapons and it's your propulsion, your primary plant. And because the Coast Guard is a fairly tight organization, as a first class, as an MK1, how does that feedback loop come up from the Coast Guard ship, up the Coast Guard chain of command, to address some of the issues that you have from a technical standpoint, either as something that's working or something not, or if you have a brilliant idea of your ability or your confidence that feedback loop is going to work well?
You run it up the chain of command, of course, and then if your idea is suitable or if it's a better way of doing something, let's say, we can put in like an engineering change report, an ECR, and of course it's got to get passed up, you know, through the higher levels, and then if it works, it works. You know, I've heard of a couple that went through, and we've had to make changes on the, you know, on different units and stuff like that, but from a personal standpoint, I've never had something like that, but there are programs set in place that if you do have somebody that does have an idea or something that if they want to improve something or bring something to life, then there is a way to do that.
Well, after 12 years in the Coast Guard, good things must have happened to keep you in. What are those good things?
Well, I love the Coast Guard as an organization. Like I said, one of the best decisions I've made in my life is joining right out of high school. I've gained a lot of leadership, you know, regime that, you know, learning, and I had no engineering background when I joined the Coast Guard, and now, you know, I'm an MK1, so I've definitely grown in that field a lot, and by just stability in the organization, I've never had a problem with it. It's always been there for me. I try to be there for it, you know, as much as I can, and I've gained my family through it and seen, you know, all up and down the East Coast, worked with a bunch of different systems and equipment that I never thought I'd be working with. So it's been a very good growing opportunity.
And one of the things in skill sets that y'all have in the Coast Guard that we constitutionally don't have in the Navy is there's a law enforcement angle to that. And I know on your last deployment on the Escanaba doing counter-narcotics, y'all had a couple of interesting occasions to recheck your weapons qualifications and utilization. But on aboard a ship like that, how do y'all organize your law enforcement teams? Do y'all bring on a dedicated trained law enforcement detachment, or like damage control teams, do you have more than one? And how do they train for that?
We have a couple of teams set up on board that do the LE missions. It's pretty much voluntary on board. If you want to do it, you know, you can go through the training. They have schools they can send you to, plus you can also do the training at ships. We do recertification training all the time, you know, with the newly qualified people, with some of the upper people that's been doing it for a while. And me personally, I'm not in that position. I didn't join up when I got to the ship because I have other collateral duties that I have to do. But the guys that do it, you know, they love it. They're hardcore. And, you know, like you said, you know, we had a couple of incidents of SAS Patrol that made us really look at, you know, how we're doing things in the Coast Guard and stuff like that. So hopefully we'll see some changes come down the pipe, you know, on the way that we deal when we're on drug interdiction patrols and, you know, the bi-group patrols and stuff like that. But I can't really, I don't know what's going on with it, so I can't really comment on it, but I'm definitely hoping, just talking to some of my guys on board, that we definitely get some changes and some better opportunity to advance our knowledge in the field.
I think you, YN2 and AT1 both talked, and you mentioned earlier that one of the things that's attractive about your job is the wide variety of things you get to do. Would you expand on that a little bit?
Just working with various systems and not being, let's say, pinned down to one job, it's challenging, and sometimes it can be very hectic and very stressful, but at the same time, just, you know, think of the knowledge you're gaining. I know about water systems that I probably would have never known about, and I can apply a lot of the stuff I will apply when I get out of the Coast Guard to possibly another job or, you know, to school or whatever I decide to do once I make, you know, once I get to that point in my career where I'm going to retire. So
one thing, another thing interesting about the Coast Guard is, unlike the Navy that likes to pack everybody into these huge bases, y'all are scattered all over the place. You know, you're up in Boston, you know, we got the folks all the way up in Kodiak, even more isolated. And just looking at that, I think one of the interesting things is how you do regular skate, scheduled significant maintenance, a yard period, for lack of a better phrase. And especially in your specialty, how often do y'all go into a shipyard to do some significant repairs or upgrades? And as an MK1, how do you interface with the civilian shipyard personnel, and how does that relationship work with ship's company as you're going through these yard periods? Because y'all scattered all over the place, aren't you?
Oh, yes. I've only been through one yard period, and that was on the Escanaba when we were here. We were last year around like September, October time frame. We went to New York, and we did a yard period up there, and that was my first one, so I was very nervous about it. I was in one of the many inspectors that we had on board for a bunch of various different jobs, and my experience working with the civilians was very knowledgeable. They were very helpful in teaching you, and plus you got to see just the ship out of the water is an amazing sight. You know, that's not every day you see that, and ripping into the system and actually getting into the guts of the system and just checking, you know, like pipes they cut out or what actually is going on in machinery that you don't normally get to take apart and look at because it's constantly running. Or, you know, you just can't because of the mission. But it was a very eye-opening experience when you actually get into the meat of the systems. And I'm not sure about the time frame because, like I said, this is my first one. I missed my other one on the Campbell, so the Escanaba was my first one. But it was a very cool experience.
Well, as you look forward, do you have any idea how much longer you could be on the Escanaba and where you go next?
I transfer out this summer, so I'm looking hopefully June, July time frame, and I'm looking to go back south this time. I got Mobile as a pick, I got North Carolina, and then, of course, Gloucester, Massachusetts.
I think that's pronounced Gloucester. I'm really not sure. We'll have to ask Maggie on that. Here's obviously up in the Northeast, you're close to the Canadians. Have you had a chance to work much with the Canadian Coast Guard, and did you have some observations on them? And I also know that when you were down doing your counter-narcotics, you worked with some of our friends in South America. What were some of the observations that you had working with your counterparts in the other nations?
As far as working with the Canadian Coast Guard, we did go up for the bicentennial of the Canadian Navy, and that was a very cool experience. That was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. We got to go up there, you know, see some of their ships, interact with some of the people up there, and that was a very great experience. As far as working with our ally, with our counterparts down south, being in the MK field and being in the engineering field, I didn't deal with them too much, so I can't really comment on, you know, the relationship that they had between them. But, you know, we got to work with Colombians, we got to work with I think the Honduran Coast Guard at one point, and it had to be a good experience. But like I said, I wasn't privy to a lot of it.
On a smaller boat, if you were to go to a smaller cutter or boat of some kind, would you have duties as a watch officer on the deck, on the bridge, or is that something you would never do because of your rating?
No, on the smaller ships, then you can't. You would be an OD on a. You'd be standing watch on the bridge just because of the crew size. But that's not something that I would ever do on a 270 or like the Escanaba or any other boat like that, any of the larger ships.
Well, Tony, I think that wraps us up for the hour. Thank you very much for coming in this Sunday and spending some time with us. And are you staying up in Massachusetts for Thanksgiving, or are you coming back down south?
Nope, I'll be staying up here. We're going to my wife's father's house.
You're a wise man. And I'd like